From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Jonathan Franzen. His best-selling novel, The Corrections, won a National Book Award last week. He was already famous as the novelist that Oprah uninvited after choosing him for her book club. Also, David Levitt talks about his novel, Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing, which has just come out in paperback. It's about the publishing world as seen by a young gay writer and his famous writing teacher. And John Powers reviews the new movie Spy Game, starring Robert Redford and Brad Pitt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. U.S. officials say they are not convinced the Taliban will surrender Kunduz. It's the last city still in Taliban control in northern Afghanistan. Northern Alliance commanders say the Taliban plans to put down its weapons by Sunday. Opposition forces have taken up positions near the city. According to witnesses from the southern part of Afghanistan, the U.S. bombing in their region has grown significantly more precise in the past week. From Quetta, NPR's Sarah Chase reports.
A man here with close contacts to the tribal leadership in Kandahar said around 3:30 a.m. last Monday morning, for example, some Al-Qaeda members were sharing a pre-dawn meal in a village outside Kandahar. Their compound was bombed, killing 25, the man said, and no one else was touched. There were cows grazing just outside, and the cows were fine, he said, adding that everybody in the region is happy and impressed with this precision. Other examples he gave include an Al-Qaeda pickup truck in Kandahar City and a column of tanks brought back with retreating Taliban troops from the northern front and hidden in a dry riverbed. According to two different Taliban commanders, the movement's leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, was almost hit several times, and for security he cut his communications with commanders in the north, contributing to the rout there. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Quetta, Pakistan.
Afghanistan is the most heavily mined country in the world, and now there is another threat. Unexploded bombs from U.S. airstrikes are scattered across the terrain. One of them is a 1,000-pound bomb at Kabul's airport. Crews are working to defuse it, and other agencies are trying to locate the remaining unexploded mines and bombs. Federal investigators say initial test results show no sign of anthrax in the mail handled by a 94-year-old woman who died of inhalation anthrax earlier this week. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
The mail that Otillie Lundgren opened in the weeks before her death reportedly shows no sign of anthrax contamination. Lundgren's mailbox and local post office have also tested negative, but federal investigators caution these results are preliminary. Friends and relatives of Lundgren say in the weeks before her death, she visited the library, a beauty parlor, and church. Investigators are working these sites today, taking environmental samples that could provide clues about how the 94-year-old woman contracted inhalation anthrax. The case continues to baffle officials. It's hard to connect Lundgren's death to the death of four others who've died from inhalation anthrax. Each of these people had closer links to a contaminated site or region. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
In the Middle East, a senior military leader of the militant Islamic group Hamas was killed today by an Israeli missile near the West Bank town of Nablus. A Hamas official vowed revenge, saying there will be a painful response to the Israeli killing. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 125 points to 9,959. The Nasdaq was up 28, the S&P up 13. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. The UN War Crimes Tribunal has agreed to hear genocide charges against former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, stemming from the war in Bosnia. Milosevic had already been charged with war crimes in Kosovo and Croatia, but the Bosnia indictment is the first to include genocide. The Coast Guard has managed to attach a line to a drifting oil tanker that was headed toward the shoreline of Washington State. The ship is carrying 20,000 gallons of fuel oil and was less than 30 miles from the southern coast when it was secured. The supertanker was being towed to China when the line broke during a storm. Neither a slow economy nor the fear of terrorism kept shoppers away from stores today. People looking for a good bargain lined up early as 5 this morning in front of some stores. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Chicago.
Friday after Thanksgiving normally marks the unofficial start of the holiday shopping season. This year, it's a crucial day for merchants hoping to turn around a slump in retail sales. And it got off to a good start. There were crowds of bargain hunters waiting for shopping malls to open long before sunrise. In other areas, the flow of shoppers started slow and increased steadily over the course of the day. Many analysts had predicted this could be the worst holiday for retailers in recent history. Stores slashed prices, ran a glut of ads, and offered coupons as a way to entice shoppers in. In Chicago, some items were marked down 80% or more. The long lines throughout the day at the checkout counter sent U.S. retail stock higher and gave merchants more hope for the holiday shopping season. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Chicago.
Brooks Brothers, known for its conservative men's clothing, has been sold to the company that owns Casual Corner Stores for $225 million. I'm Mac Lee, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Jonathan Franzen won a National Book Award last week for his novel The Corrections, he was already famous as the only writer Oprah had uninvited after choosing him for her book club. In fact, a couple of his comments that apparently offended her were made on Fresh Air. Now that he's won the National Book Award, we're going to listen back to highlights of that interview, not the comments about the book club, but his reflections about his novel and about family. The novel seems particularly timely around the holidays. It revolves around the lives of three adult children who live far away from the Midwestern town where their aging parents live. The father has a degenerative disease and can no longer take care of himself, and caring for him is becoming more than the mother can handle. In the meantime, her wish is to bring her three children and two grandchildren back home for a final Christmas dinner. But the children don't really want to go, and they're not sure how much they're willing to change their own lives to take care of their parents. The novel is also a social satire about family, work, and trends in everything from food to political correctness. Our interview was recorded in October. We started with a reading from the opening of The Corrections. An aging hipster living in New York is waiting at the airport for his Midwestern parents to arrive.
Down the long concourse, they came unsteadily. Enid favoring her damaged hip, Alfred paddling at the air with loose-hinged hands and slapping the airport carpeting with poorly controlled feet, both of them carrying Nordic Pleasure Line's shoulder bags and concentrating on the floor in front of them, measuring out the hazardous distance three paces at a time. To anyone who saw them averting their eyes from the dark-haired New Yorkers careering past them, to anyone who caught a glimpse of Alfred's straw fedora looming at the height of Iowa corn on Labor Day, or the yellow wool of the slack stretching over Enid's outslung hip, it was obvious that they were Midwestern and intimidated. But to Chip Lambert, who was waiting for them just beyond the security checkpoint, they were killers. Chip had crossed his arms defensively and raised one hand to pull on the wrought iron rivet in his ear. He worried that he might tear the rivet right out of his earlobe, that the maximum pain his ears' nerves could generate was less pain than he needed now to steady himself. From his position by the metal detectors, he watched an azure-haired girl overtake his parents, an azure-haired girl of college age, a very wantable stranger with pierced lips and eyebrows. It struck him that if he could have sex with this girl for 1 second, he could face his parents confidently, and that if he could keep on having sex with this girl once every minute for as long as his parents were in town, he could survive their entire visit. Chip was a tall, gym-built man with crow's feet and sparse, butter-yellow hair. If the girl had noticed him, she might have thought he was a little too old for the leather he was wearing. As she hurried past him, he pulled harder on his rivet to offset the pain of her departure from his life forever and to focus his attention on his father, whose face was brightening at the discovery of a son among so many strangers. In the lunging manner of a man floundering in water, Alfred fell upon Chip and grabbed Chip's hand and wrist as if they were a rope he'd been thrown. "Well," he said, "well." Enid came limping up behind him. "Chip," she cried, "what have you done to your ears?" "Dad, Mom," Chip murmured through his teeth, hoping the azure-haired girl was out of earshot. "Good to see you."
You know, the book is in part about that moment in an adult's life when they see their parents go from this kind of almost threatening presence, a controlling presence, to being people who are very weak and very much in need of help from their children, as opposed to people who are trying to control their children. What made you focus on that transition, that realization in your book?
Well, part of it grew out of my own experience, and I'm guessing you'll have a question or two along those lines.
he said resentfully.
No. No, I don't watch Oprah, but I do listen to your show. So let me leapfrog over that to some of the more thematic reasons why I was attracted
Good.
To that.
Okay.
It seems I grew up feeling like I was a child and adults were adults, and I seem to have grown into a time and a place where people don't really want to be adults in the same way I understood them to be, which was well-mannered people who dress differently than children, and who were in some way put their children's interests before their own. And all around just were of a different class. They liked being adults. They got a satisfaction from that. And ever since the boomer generation faced the problem of adulthood with kind of dubious results, and since so much of commercial culture has come to focus on the 18 to 34 demographic, it seems as if adulthood itself is to some extent a threatened commodity. And yet there is this feeling in the back of one's head, there are those parents, and I get to be a child even up into my 40s, 50s, and 60s because those parents are there. And it seemed to me an interesting question of to look at. What happens when you do finally lose those parents and you're next in line? That's an interesting question for me, and it goes to some of the more culturally critical undercurrents in the book.
Could you have written this novel only after the death of your parents? Would you have feared that the novel would have some way hurt them, or they would have felt betrayed by it, thinking that a lot of the characterizations in them were really about them?
Or about them and their friends, about their
right.
cohort, certainly, which is what this is drawn from. It's not per se a portrait of my parents. It's more a portrait of a type that my parents were one instance of that I saw a lot of when I was growing up in the Midwest. My father was unhappy with certain things in my second book. He felt, I think, betrayed by what he perceived as a criticism of religion, when in fact, I don't think there is one there. My mother had, by that point, long since learned how to read my books without reading them and how to skim the cream off the experience of my being a writer without actually having to, down the milk underneath it. And she was alive as various pieces of this book were being published in magazines to which she had access. And it was interesting to see how she responded to that. She, in one instance, asked me to give a paragraph-by-paragraph synopsis, or accepted my offer to give a paragraph-by-paragraph synopsis of a chunk of this that was in The New Yorker, just so she didn't have to cast her eyes over it herself. And I think... my father was a stricter person, and I think might have been more prone to make moral judgments. My mother, at that point in her life, really was bent on getting along with her kids and would have let nothing stop that. And I indeed wrote much of it when she was still alive and with the hope that she would be alive to see it published.
Your novel keeps shifting point of view. It's written from the point of view of each of the three adult children in this family, as well as from the point of view as the mother and father. What are some of the things you were trying to do novelistically in having the point of view keep changing?
Well, that seems to be a fixture of all my books. and I think it comes from the essential blurriness of my own nature. I don't seem to be able to be the same person on any two consecutive days, whether in as straightforward a way as the fact that I'm moody and you know, kind of fairly elated one day and then anxious and gloomy the next, to the fact that I feel like at once a 12-year-old boy and a 78-year-old man and a 42-year-old man and a 32-year-old woman. I just, it grows out of my own sense of having a multitude of voices in myself and being unwilling or perhaps unable to settle on any single one of them. There are really two kinds of writers, I think, in that regard. There are the ventriloquists or the empaths, which is what I think I am, and then there are the people who have a strong, really, really strong native voice and who will do everything in their own voice. And probably it's a good idea for me to keep trying to do that because I don't know if I will ever be able to settle on a single voice.
Is that ability to see many different points of view simultaneously ever paralyzing in real life when you have to be decisive and figure out which one direction or which one to head in or which one point of view to have?
You could ask any of my friends or anyone in my family that question and they would all start laughing. No, I'm kind of classically paralytic as far as I seem to just find myself again and again in every way in situations of conflict and ambivalence and paralysis. And yeah, so it's debilitating in a life way, but it's fun on the page, and that's
right.
That's probably what makes me a writer.
You know, there's the character, the son Chip, in your novel, writes for a little journal that's called the Warren Street Journal, and it's a kind of journal of transgressive culture. And
yeah,
and he says that at the offices of the journal, he sometimes felt insufficiently transgressive, as if his innermost self were still a nice Midwestern boy. Is that something you felt about yourself, that your innermost self was a nice Midwestern boy, and that you had to put on these transgressive clothes to kind of cover that up?
Yes and no. I mean, in some senses, that sentence could describe me. In others, in other respects, though, that would appear to discount the sincerity or the intensity of the anger I felt about the way our culture was set up when I was writing my first two books. I think for Chip, it manifests as a sense of fraudulence. For me, it manifests as a tension. I am both a nice Midwestern boy and somebody who is thinking hard about the way we live and the reasons we live that way. Chip is not me, but I certainly sympathize with that particular moment, that spasm of fraudulent feeling that he has.
My guest is Jonathan Franzen, author of The Corrections. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Jonathan Franzen. His novel, The Corrections, won a National Book Award last week. You know, in the piece you wrote about your father's Alzheimer's disease in The New Yorker, you said that watching your father lose his intelligence, sanity, and self-consciousness, you found yourself becoming less afraid of losing those abilities yourself. You became a little less afraid in general. I really wanted to know why. I mean, because so often it's the other way around. You see somebody you love deteriorate and you really worry about your own future.
Well, again, I was a very old 8-year-old. I really meant it when I say, well, as Lydia Davis in a famous, very short story of hers says, you know, there was a young woman who considered herself an old woman, and she would ask herself, why are these young men flirting with this old lady? You know, I identified so much with my parents that I was always their age. And One thing that happened was that when they got sick and died, I couldn't identify with them anymore. I was actually freed to be my own real age. Beyond that, I think you know that people close to you are going to die, and you live in fear of that, especially if they're as important to you as my parents were to me. And realizing that I could walk into a room with my father, you know, raving mad, or walk into a room where he was barely breathing and near death, that here comes this thing which is unimaginable, that I'm terrified of, and yet I'm going through it. In a way, I translated that directly onto what he was going through. That is, it had been, you know, it was unimaginable, obviously, to him as to all of us. Like, how am I going to get through death? And to see that this one terrifying, unimaginable thing that I've been imagining or I'd been facing and fearing indeed could be traversed did make me less afraid of other painful possibilities of in the future, including losing those various things.
And there's something you write about your father's actual death. You say, I don't like to remember how impatient I was for my father's breathing to stop, how ready to be free of him I was.
Well, I think that goes back to the idea of a very disciplined person letting go. Interestingly, I felt that I myself was a supremely disciplined writer. You know, I would have 6 to 10 cigarettes a day. I would sit down at 9 in the morning and I would write until 5. And I produced these very together novels, these two books that I found rather unassailable, at least emotionally. And yet, as he was falling apart, I was realizing that that old kind of all-controlling way of writing was just no longer working for me, and that I needed, however scary the prospect was, I needed to let go of something as a writer. I needed to fall apart a little bit myself. And again, you know, when it was clear he was going to die, it was just a matter of, you know, is it going to be at 9 o'clock or at 12 o'clock? I did feel this building sense of exhilaration to be free, first of all, of this week-long vigil that my mother and I had been sitting, and also to you know, get on with being my own person and to let go and do that after that strong father was gone.
You know, sometimes our self-image is tied to the way other people see us, you know, to the mirrors they hold up to us. And a lot of that has to do with how our parents saw us when we were coming of age. That sticks with you a long time. How did it affect your image of yourself to have your father forget who you were or mistake you for somebody else? And so, like, the mirror he's holding up to you is, like, the wrong image.
Well, that was nothing new. I had been mistaken for a lot of things by both my parents before that happened. I'd been mistaken for a budding young scientist or engineer or a possible lawyer or possible banker or possible international journalist. So that sense of not being known for myself came to me at the age of about 7, and indeed is probably at the center of why I write. It's to try to say over and over again, no, I'm not that, I'm this. But that is, of course, the paradox of Alzheimer's. They talk about, you know, the sufferer losing himself, but what's in fact happening is that the people around him are losing their selves with respect to the mirror that the sufferer is holding up.
As I think I've mentioned, I really like your novel, The Corrections, a lot. And I think part of the problem I knew I would encounter in interviewing you is that the story in the novel has a lot to do with relationships and the kind of psychological connections between people. The tone of the novel is great because of how the tone keeps shifting from person to person, and your terrific use of language and the type of humor that you put into it. But my fear was, and perhaps I've sadly succeeded in doing this, that I would end up reducing some of your novel to this kind of psychopathology, because things are hard to talk about sometimes and to maintain the tone that your novel does while talking about it. But I figure I'm not the only one who's going to be pushing you into that particular corner. You're being interviewed a lot, and probably a lot of people like myself are trying to turn your novel into, a personal introspection, or, you know, at the worst end of it, some kind of psychobabble. So has it been hard for you? And I offer myself as one of the guilty parties here. I mean, I've tried my best, but I know I'm going to end up being a little reductionist in the way I treat it.
Well, it's part of a problem I've been experiencing again and again as I've been out on this book tour. People, I'm not very interesting. I mean, I really I'm not. Or you know, if you spend a day with me, you might find me interesting if you're so inclined. But I really, really work hard on trying to make a book work and be full and entertaining. And I feel as if the book is having this success. And then people turn to me and say, well, you know, if Lou Reed cuts a record, or if Bob Dylan cuts a record, you listen to the music and then you look at the guy who cut the record and you can see, you know, that they're more or less identical. Here it's like I worked for many years to find that tone for the book, and I worked for many years to come up with a structure that would make the book really, really work. And yet that's intrinsically uninteresting material. So there is this kind of, okay, well, let's talk about the person then. And then I sort of trot out my my really rather ordinary life experiences and feel as if I'm a disappointment. That's the chief nature of. I mean, I understand you have to do an interview, and I understand an author interview is a brutally hard thing to do for a fiction writer, at any rate. And I probably am not alone among fiction writers in feeling like, I wish I had something more interesting to say, but the book is where it's at. The author is not.
Well, Jonathan Franzen, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for talking to me.
Jonathan Franzen, recorded in October. Last week, his novel The Corrections won a National Book Award. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers, and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Vintage Books, paperback publishers of The True History of the Kelly Gang, the new novel by Peter Carey. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Levitt talks about his novel Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's about the publishing world as seen by a young gay writer and his famous writing teacher. It's just come out in paperback. And John Powers reviews Spy Game, starring Robert Redford and Brad Pitt. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Levitt knows about the problems a writer can run into when his fiction is based on his life and friends and family feel their secrets have been betrayed. It's something the main character in Levitt's latest novel learns, too. The novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's just been published in paperback. It's about a young writer trying to break into print while supporting himself at a publishing house where he's assigned to read through the slush pile. He's also trying to figure out how to come out of the closet. David Levitt's first book, a collection of short stories, was published in 1984 when he was 23 and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Penn Faulkner Prize. Now with several books and a couple of major writing controversies under his belt, he's a professor guiding young writers. Levitt's novel begins when the main character, Martin Bauman, is in college, taking Professor Stanley Flint's famous seminar, The Art of Writing Fiction. Flint is a professor who cultivates an aura of mystic authority. I spoke with David Levitt last fall when the novel was published in hardcover. We started with a short reading.
Flint's seminar, to say the least, had a different rhythm. It worked like this. At the beginning of each session, a student would be asked to read aloud from his or her work. The student would then read one sentence. If Flint liked the sentence, the student would be allowed to continue. If he did not, however, and this was much more common, the student would be cut off, shut up, sent to the corner. A torrent of eloquence would follow, the ineffectuality of this slight undergraduate effort providing an occasion for Flint to hold forth dazzlingly and about anything at all. His most common complaint was that the sentence amounted to baby talk or throat clearing, this latter accusation almost invariably followed by the invocation, "Remember Flint's first principle," and from us, the responsorial chant, "Get on with it." Soon we understood that Flint loathed boyfriend stories, stories in which the protagonist was a writer, stories set in restaurants or cocktail lounges. To cocktail lounges, he showed a particular aversion. Any story set in a cocktail lounge would provoke from him a wail of lamentation, delivered in a voice both stentorian and grave, a sermonizer's voice, for the truth was, there was something deeply ministerial about Flint. Meanwhile, the student whose timid words had provoked this outpouring would have no choice but to sit and percolate, humiliated, occasionally letting out little gasps of self-defense, which Flint would immediately quash. An atmosphere of hyperventilation ensued. The windows steamed. Those Flint had maligned stared at him, choking on the sentences in which, a moment earlier, they had taken such pride, and which he was now shoving back down their throats. Yet when, on occasion, he did like a sentence, or even more rarely, when he allowed a student to move from the first sentence to the second, or from the second to the third, it was as if a window had been thrown open, emitting a breath of air into the churning humidity of that room, and yet a breath that would cool the face of the chosen student only, bathing him or her in the delightful breeze of laudation, while outside its influence the rest of us sweltered, wiping our noses, mopping our brows.
A lot of people figure that the teacher in this novel is based on Gordon Lish, the writer, editor, and teacher who mm-hmm. was one of your teachers at Yale. Mm-hmm. Assuming that you had someone, Gordon Lish or someone else in your life, who had, as you describe it, an aura of mystic authority.
Uh-huh.
I wonder what impact that had on you as a young, growing writer. You know, I could see how you'd really become a praise junkie in a situation like that, where criticism was the equivalent of humiliation, because you weren't allowed to read any further if you didn't like the first sentence, mm-hmm. and praise was elevated to like bowing before you in praise. I don't know. It could really turn you into a manic depressive or a praise junkie.
Well, I love that term, praise junkie. I've never heard that before, but I think it's perfect. The thing about me and to a great degree about Martin Bauman, who is sort of my alter ego in this book, is that I think I was a praise junkie long before I ever started taking writing classes. That was something that was really endemic to my character from very early on. But certainly the habit of being a praise junkie probably meant that I was particularly attracted to teachers of this sort, which I think a lot of people are, because a teacher like this really makes you feel that his or her praise means something. At the same time, I have to applaud the kind of teacher that Stanley Flint is for instilling in his students an extremely high standard and making them feel that they're always striving to achieve that standard and that once they've achieved it, the bar goes higher. So there's always something more to achieve. And I think that that's very healthy for a writer. When you become too complacent or too sure of yourself, it seems to me your writing usually suffers. Whereas if you're constantly trying to do something that you feel you can't do, your writing grows.
If you have the strength to withstand that kind of criticism, which not everybody mm-hmm. does, did you?
Oh, yes. I'm pretty tough. I'm very thick-skinned when it comes to criticism. I mean, which doesn't mean that it doesn't.
How can you be so thick-skinned and a praise junkie at the same time?
Well, let's put it this way. I've always been a praise junkie, but I've become thick-skinned over the years because I've had to. Martin is not only a praise junkie, he's also avidly in love with the idea of being a writer. And he does have very high standards for himself, and he does want to be the best writer he can be. And that, in a funny way, militates against the praise junkie in him. There's a point in the book in which I talk about this, and I discuss about how the fact that in every writer there are really two beings. On the one hand, there's the artist who works in isolation. And on the other hand, there is the professional who is both his enabler but at the same time his enemy, because what the professional has to do goes against the very nature of what the writer has to do. And yet the two need each other, even though they're constantly in conflict.
How are they at odds?
They're at odds because writing is such a deeply private process. You sit alone in a room and create, and you dig things out of very private parts of yourself that in an ordinary situation you would never have to expose. Writing fiction is a process of self-excavation to a great degree. Well, then when you publish a book, you're suddenly taken out of the situation of an almost artificial privacy and thrust into exactly the opposite situation. You're suddenly in the public limelight. And even though you can tell yourself 1,000 times it isn't me, it's the book, at the same time, the book comes out of you. And so you naturally feel a very personal sense of identification with it. And when you think about it, those are very opposing impulses. And it's tricky to manage to be both those people at the same time, especially because there's something about the process of having to sell yourself, which every writer obviously has to do, that goes very much against the grain of writing from an artistic impulse.
I want to get back to the teacher in your novel, Stanley
yeah.
Flint. He's somebody who's full of like principles that young writers should follow and everything. And his second mm-hmm. principle is to perceive something one had gone through as particular or special was to commit not merely an error but a sin against art. He wanted writers to articulate the commonality that binds us all.
Yes.
Talk to us more about this principle and whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's good advice.
Well, you know, I'm not really
given to having principles.
Well, no, I mean I have principles, but I'm not very pronouncy.
yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
By comparison to Stanley Flint. However, I do think it is true, particularly in the age we're living in now, that writers need to remember that fiction is about making an experience accessible to someone who hasn't had it necessarily. And since we're living in an age where if you go into a bookstore, you'll see literature or fiction subdivided by all kinds of ethnic and sexual divisions. For example, the Borders I was in recently, where I found that my books were under gay and lesbian literature, but not under just literature. And then there was another section for black literature, and I noticed that Toni Morrison was there, but she wasn't under literature. When you're in a world which is so inclined to compartmentalize, I think it's very important to remember that the whole point of literature is to move beyond the particulars. The particulars are important, but so is the common ground that underlies them.
Another bit of criticism that the teacher in this novel passes on to the student, your alter ego, is this. And this is about a story that the teacher has read of the students. The trouble was it read like a public service announcement. Also, you write as if homosexuality itself was interesting. It's not interesting. All that's interesting is individual experience. What does the teacher mean here, and what do you think of the advice?
Good advice. I would give it to a student. I think what the teacher means is that for fiction to come alive, for fiction to really mean something to a reader, it has to describe lived experience, lived human experience. And one of the problems, I think, with a lot of so-called gay fiction, particularly in the late 70s and early 80s, was that there lay behind it a kind of propagandistic impulse or a political impulse, the impulse being to somehow further a cause, to make the cause being or the purpose being to make the lives of homosexuals more publicly known or to portray homosexual men, particularly in a more positive light, which is a noble idea, but one that runs completely contrary to the essence of fiction, which, again, is always about individual experience. And when I look at my literary heroes and heroines, the writers I admire the most, what distinguishes them is the degree to which they seem to move beyond both genre and propaganda. If you look at a novel like Howard's End by Ann Forster, which is one of my favorite novels, there's a deeply political and somewhat subversive subtext to that novel that has to do with the destruction of a certain way of life by technology. And yet on another level, this is simply a story about the lives of human beings who interact and whose motives clash. And the novel works very well on both levels. You have to have both levels, though. Otherwise, you'll have what is more like a board game with the characters functioning as pieces in a kind of plot that has a moral or political purpose. And that's not fiction. That's propaganda.
My guest is writer David Levitt. His latest novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with David Levitt. His novel, Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing, has just been published in paperback. Your character publishes his first story in a magazine, and that first story is about him coming out to his parents. And he imagines himself saying to his parents, Mom, Dad, guess what? I'm coming out in the magazine. Now, the first story you published in The New Yorker was a story about a gay character.
Yes.
Did your parents already know you were gay, or was that part of your coming out?
All that happened more or less exactly as it happens to Martin in the book. It was the sort of double whammy. And we were talking earlier about the idea of being a praise junkie. In some ways, I think I hoped to temper what I feared they would perceive as a piece of disappointing news by offering it in tandem with a piece of news that they couldn't help but be excited by, which was that I was publishing a story in The New Yorker. And that seemed to me a strategy that is probably very typical for young gay men and lesbians to try to achieve in order to compensate for what they fear will be a great disappointment to their parents.
Well, let me just point out about something about how you might have played your cards wrong here. Because you're basically saying, Mom, Dad, I'm coming out. The good news is I'm getting published in the magazine. But the bad news is now the whole world is going to know. And it's probably like the last thing in the world they wanted the whole world to know while they were first absorbing it.
But in a funny way, that it was necessary for me at that point to tell the whole world and not merely to tell them. But you're right. I think it came as a real shock because it meant that something they might otherwise have boasted about to their friends became a lot more complex.
Yeah.
And this was all years ago. And now, with my father, we laugh about this because it seems so much a part of the past. But at the time, it was, a big deal.
So did they brag to friends that you were in The New Yorker, or was that something they tried not to talk about?
Well, actually, this is yet another instance in which the novel diverges from reality. I had told them that I had a story coming out in The New Yorker long before I told them that I was gay. So they had already started boasting to their friends. Subsequently, I came home and told them what the story was about, and they had to sort of double back to compensate or to sort of alert their friends to what was going on. And yet that didn't seem to me, this is an example of how sometimes reality just doesn't work in a novel. It can be the jumping off point for the novel, but it isn't necessarily the, I don't know, the best way to handle something in a novel.
Oh, great. Now tell me why that wouldn't have worked in your novel and how you changed it in the novel.
Well, I'll tell you, I think it wouldn't have worked in the novel because even though it was true, I found it hard. I wasn't convinced that readers would be persuaded that Martin's mother would never have asked him what the story was about, which is what happened to me. I said, "Mom, I'm publishing a story in the New Yorker." My mother never asked me what the story was about. Now, if I tell you that that really happened, you'll believe me, though you might, I would imagine, be surprised, because what mother isn't going to ask that question, I would think. And yet I felt that I couldn't get away with that in a novel because it strained credibility too much. And so I reconfigured it so that Martin wouldn't actually tell them that he was coming out until he had a story coming out in the magazine, until he also, at the same moment, told them that he was gay. The other reason I did that was because I wanted to end the chapter with the line, "Mom, Dad, I'm coming out in the magazine."
So why do you think your mother didn't ask you?
Because I think my mother probably, on some level, guessed.
Ah, okay.
And didn't want to know.
Right. Anybody who, like you, writes fiction that is based somewhat on autobiography and on the experiences of people mm-hmm. who are close to you risks hurting or offending those people who are close to you, because they might read something that seems like it's based on something that really happened to them, and either they interpret the incident differently or they're insulted about the way you've characterized them or they feel that you've betrayed a secret of theirs. How have you dealt with that as a writer? Has that been a problem for you?
I consider it an occupational hazard. And it's been a problem for me to some degree. And yet, I've got to say, in all honesty, I have been written about. I have been the subject of fiction. So I've stood on both sides of this fence. And it seems to me, especially when the people in question are also writers, it's very important to remember that no matter how upset we may be by what other people write about us, if we start yelling and screaming about it, we're threatening the very freedom on which our own creative lives depend. The other thing I want to say about this, which I think is really important, is that I think any serious writer is writing for the future, not for the present.
Mm-hmm.
And these kinds of issues are relevant only for a very short time. And it seemed to me that it would be a great artistic mistake to hold back on something for fear of hurting someone in the short run, which doesn't mean that you should go and write something that's sadistic or cruel, but I think you really will hurt yourself as a writer if you leave out some aspect of your own experience simply for the sake of not wanting to offend someone else who was part of that experience. And the thing to remember, of course, is that human experience, no one owns human experience. If you and I have a conversation, it belongs to both of us. And I think it belongs to both of us in an artistic sense as well, and we both have the right to write about it, which is why I would never, ever voice an objection to anyone writing anything about me, no matter how much I personally disliked it, no matter how much I was hurt or offended by it.
Well, have you been hurt or offended by things people have written about you?
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Many times.
Name something.
Fiction and journalism. Well, my an ex of mine wrote a short story about a character who was very clearly based on me that was published in an anthology a few years ago
mm-hmm.
that I was quite, I would say I was wounded by.
What was wounding about it?
What was wounding about it was that it seemed to me personally unjust. However, I realized that that was irrelevant to the story's value as literature. Whether I personally considered it unjust was a little bit like what, I mean, it ties into what Stanley Flint says at the end. Do you really think I'm, when he quotes Beethoven as saying, "Do you really think I'm worrying about your miserable fiddle when I compose?" Feelings of something being unjust, feeling of something being unfair, that's the miserable fiddle. And what matters is not the fiddle. What matters is the composition. And I will allow that story, no matter what I might have felt about it personally, has every right to exist and every right to remain in the arena of literature, because finally I was just the jumping off point for it.
Well, David Levitt, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure, as always.
David Levitt recorded last fall after the publication of his novel Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's just been published in paperback. Levitt also has a new collection of short stories called The Marble Quilt. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie Spy Game. This is Fresh Air. Robert Redford and Brad Pitt star in the new thriller Spy Game. It's directed by Tony Scott, whose movies include The Hunger, Top Gun, Crimson Tide, and Enemy of the State. Although Spy Game finished shooting before September 11th, film critic John Power says it's a movie of the moment.
Talk about hitting the zeitgeist right on the button. For the last 2 months, the whole country's been saying that our intelligence services need to get smarter, tougher, and more hands-on. Now here comes director Tony Scott with a revved-up star vehicle that makes old-fashioned spying seem cool. Set in 1991, Spy Game stars Robert Redford as Nathan Muir, a CIA case officer of the old school, ruthless but in the service of the greater good. He's about to make a clean retirement when his idealistic but still murderous protege Tom Bishop, that's Brad Pitt, gets captured by the Chinese trying to rescue an imprisoned aid worker, played by Catherine McCormick. He's going to be executed in 24 hours. Naturally, the agency's slippery bigwigs are prepared to sacrifice Bishop as a geopolitical chess move. Just as naturally, Muir will do anything to save him. And so even as they pump him for information about Bishop, the movie's told largely in flashbacks over many years, Muir is secretly working to spring the spy he helped bring into the service. Here, at a Berlin bar, Muir instructs his young operative in the ultimate principles of spycraft.
Was ist das an Ihrem? Haben Sie da einen anderen?
Ja. Wir haben einen besten.
Das ist mein Liebling.
I thought spies drank martinis.
Scotch. Never less than 12 years old.
Is that right? Agency rules?
My rules.
So what else? What else do I need to know?
Put away some money so you can die someplace warm. Don't ever touch it. Not for anyone, ever.
Okay. Is that it?
Don't ever risk your life or your career for an asset. It comes down to you or them, send flowers.
On the face of it, Spy Game looks to be about long twilight struggle stuff. The moral compromises involved in espionage, the patriotic need to get your hands dirty. Both Muir and Bishop perform political assassinations, and they treat those around them as, quote, assets, who can be discarded to save an operation or themselves. They do the kinds of things that make you wonder who's the good guy here, which isn't a question we usually ask during movies starring these two actors. Indeed, there's something undeniably seductive about the pairing of the weather-beaten Redford and the still fresh-faced Pitt, mirror image golden boys of different generations. It was Pitt, after all, who Redford cast to play the Redford-like role in The River Runs Through It. And Spy Game's at its best in the scenes when Muir is training Bishop in the complexities of the spy game, showing him the ropes like a jaded Obi-Wan Kenobi. Such mentoring scenes tap into mythic patterns. Harry Potter offers the same thing. And Pitt and Redford's scenes together take on an added resonance because of their iconic significance. The popular young star replacing the fading old one. Pitt, who's nearly always better than I expect he's going to be, makes the most of a specious character, the quiet American-type assassin who hasn't lost his innocence. He's got enough charisma to make us believe that Bishop could actually exist. But just when we want his role to go somewhere, it gets swallowed up in physicality. He spends a lot of the movie running and driving and getting beaten up. There's more going on inside the calculating Muir, and I have to register the irony that Redford, who once made movies that badmouthed the CIA, should now be playing a noble member of the company. Redford's always had it in him to pull off complex characters, for beneath his good looks there's a terrible coldness, what Pauline Kael once termed his male fascism. But even at age 64, he's reluctant to darken his image. So while he performs with more conviction than he's done in several years, he never quite owns up to Muir's ruthlessness in the way that, say, Gene Hackman would. He wants to stay golden. Of course, the producers want that too. For in the end, Spy Game isn't really about the down-and-dirty, hit-and-run morality of international espionage. It's about that old Hollywood wheeze redemption. Muir and Bishop turn out to be good guys, after all. And though the world they inhabit may be filled with murder and betrayal, Scott's pyrotechnic style is designed not to make us reflect on this, but to get our blood racing, to overwhelm all thoughts with his jittery editing, buttock-shaking sound, and the ultra-fast traveling shots we might term adrenaline cam. Anyway, who really cares about all that morality stuff when the stars are so good-looking, when they go to such exotic locations as Vietnam, divided Berlin, and war-torn Beirut, and when the violence is portrayed with such loving attention to detail, especially when it's only foreigners who do the dying. 15 years ago, Scott directed Top Gun, which made being a naval flyer seem as glamorous as living inside a commercial. Now, just when America needs him most, he's done much the same thing for espionage and assassination. Spy Game is surely the most expensive CIA recruiting film of all time.
John Powers is executive editor of the LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Freedom, that's what I want now. Freedom, that's what I need now. Freedom to live. Freedom so I can give. You got my heart, speak electric water. Drugstore man, well, I don't need it now. I'm just trying to slap it out of my hand. Freedom, so I can live. Freedom, so I can give. Freedom, yeah.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the mogul of hip-hop culture, Russell Simmons, co-founder of Def Jam Records. He has a new memoir called Life and Death, Sex, Drugs, Money, and God. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.